Well, the top story in South Africa at the moment is the striving for self-determination by the Afrikaner people. Hasn't been on the agenda for a long, long time, but a visit to Washington by a delegation that was warmly received by the Trump administration has sown all kinds of unhappiness here at home. If you look at social media, well, people are wanting apartheid back and more. We'll find out what the reality is from Connie Mulder, who's with Solidarity. Connie, thanks for joining us. The decision to take the trip in the first place and the compilation of those who went there, won't you just unpack that for us, please?
All right. Nice to be here, Alec, as always. I think that the decision wasn't taken by us, but it was taken for us by President Trump, quite simply put. By putting South Africa and the Afrikaner specifically in the spotlight, it was imperious that somebody do something. We cannot stand idly by and watch whilst the country that we live in, the country of our birth, is sabotaged in this term by the ANC, who seems to have a very weird relationship with America, where they want the money, but they desperately want to also punch them in the face constantly. And that means, from our perspective, it was a no-brainer to automatically assign, if you want, a delegation, and then go to America as quickly as possible to, number one, try and limit the damage done through the South African government's reckless behavior, and try and ensure that the hammer comes down on the corrupt politicians who deserve it and not on your average South African citizen. And number two, since you mentioned Afrikaners by name, as the biggest organized institution in Afrikaner circles, it is obvious that we need to go and try and establish relationships and help him understand who is the Afrikaner, what do we want, what don't we want, and how can we help him, and how can he possibly help us, if at all.
So who went?
So from our perspective, it's a very senior delegation. It's Flip Bayse, who's the chairperson of the Solidarity Movement. And that's the umbrella organization that has all AfriForum Solidarity all of them in. Then Kali Kriel, the CEO of AfriForum, Dirk Herrmann, the CEO of Solidarity, and then Jaco Kleinans, who's our head of international liaison. So he's got lots of contacts internationally, and you might know him as a well-known expert on especially American politics. So we sent the best people that we could send overseas to try and mitigate the damage to our country, but also properly represent Afrikaners and their strive for more cultural autonomy.
And what was the reception like?
The reception in America was much warmer than I think the one in South Africa. We were actually met with open arms. From what we can tell, we met senior delegations in both the White House as well as in Congress, talking to the Committee on Foreign Affairs, and the main sentiment that was received from the delegation is almost disbelief that South Africa has not come to the party. South Africa just does not show up in Washington. The ambassador, as we know, is still waiting for several of those diplomats to call him back. But it was a weird mixture of welcoming actual information from South Africa and welcoming the fact that a South African delegation actually showed up in terms of the Solidarity delegation. And then there's an understanding. Look, the Americans have a whole intelligence agency. They know exactly what's going on in South Africa, and they appreciated the extra perspective and the extra facts that we gave them in the form of several reports, which were well researched. That just shows what has been the impact of these policies and what has been the ANC's foreign policy in the past years. But most of that is just confirming what they already knew. They've studied us extensively through a couple of administrations. Due to the simple fact that the question burning in all of America's state machinery at the moment is South Africa a friend or a foe? And it has been burning for more than 10 years. And I think, unfortunately, if you talk to the ANC, the answer is a foe. And it's refreshing for America to hear from average South Africans who desperately want to counter that narrative and say, no, we're not nearly as anti-Western or anti-US as the ANC specifically is. And that then follows to don't punish the country who likes trading with the US, who doesn't have massive problems with the United States, for a couple of diplomats who got their, well, a couple of bureaucrats who got their training in the Soviet Russia and who still sees the Cold War as ongoing. That means we've moved on. The ANC is still stuck trying to phone East Berlin to find out what they should do.
From your perspective, what was the intention of what was your goal? When the delegation returned, would they have described as being mission successful?
So I think we went there with two goals. The first is, as stated, very simply put, to try and keep South Africa in AGOA, amongst others, but to try and make sure that the Americans who are really angry don't go to economic sanctions, etc., and hurt the country further for the utterances of a couple of politicians. So the first goal was to say, don't punish the country, which we've said this since 2018. That has been our point of view from the very start. Is we're a great country with a horrible government, and that means please don't punish the great country for the horrible government. There are better measures, and in effect, the message would be economic sanctions on the country is not going to affect the change that America wants to see in foreign policy. It's just not going to work. If you want to actually affect change, you would need to target the ANC individually through whichever means you can. It's not going to help to make several hundred thousand farm workers unemployed due to kicking at us out of AGOA when the ANC still has, at least the corrupt ANC, which is most of them, still has several assets overseas and will not feel that pinch at all. So it's pleading for the country to say, look, don't punish the country for the actions of a government. And the second part would then be to introduce the Americans. We've had discussions, but to say, look, you've spoken about Afrikaners, but I don't think you know a lot about us. And this is now a delegation that says, all right, this is who we are. We're most likely the vast majority of Afrikaners are not going to take up your refugee status. In Afrikaans, the word is hardkoppig. We're quite stubborn in terms of this country, and we would like to remain here. But we are desperately trying to build the infrastructure, especially cultural infrastructure, that would enable Afrikaners to not only survive in South Africa, but to actively contribute to the bigger South African society in much, much better ways than we're doing currently. And although we don't expect any help, if you want to help, this is how you can help. But ultimately, the only thing that I would think would be mission success is, one, keeping South Africa in AGOA, and two, just acknowledging that Afrikaners are a cultural minority in their own right, and that the things that they strive for aren't weird or illegal, that it's a legitimate strive.
How much of that self-determination, or when you talk about a cultural minority in their own right, how strong was that on the agenda, that we'd actually like to be able to determine our own future rather than having the dead hand of a socialist government over us?
I think if you look at Solidarity's viewpoints, that is where we're coming from as origin is we would like to decide things and to run things that at least concern Afrikaners for ourselves, and that is one of the reasons why we're vehemently opposed against Bella is we do not want some nameless diplomat or bureaucrat somewhere in an office determining the language policy of the school that our children are in. It just does not make sense. Why would that be necessary? Now, this all flows from Article 31 in the South African Constitution that explicitly states cultural communities can have cultural institutions and other organs of civil society as necessary to thrive and to enjoy their culture. So we've gone from the space available in the Constitution, and we've simply started building the cultural infrastructure necessary. And what we talk about is usually cultural autonomy, which states when we look at South Africa, we think of it as a fruit salad, meaning everyone is, you're a pineapple, you're a mango, whatever. But everyone stays what they are, but we're one dish that works well together. And when you listen to the ANC talking, they're much more in the line of this is going to be a smoothie where you need to completely lose your pineappleness in order to be part of the greater South African project. Now, we just dismiss that out of hand. We think there's no reason for different cultures in South Africa to have to become one sort of monoculture in order to succeed. One of the things that makes South Africa great is the fact that we've got this large diversity of cultures and viewpoints, and that we, at least at horizontal level, we get along quite well. We've sort of figured out how to get along. The politicians are still lagging behind the average person on the street, but we are managing it, and that means in order to stay the pineapple in the fruit salad and not be assimilated completely, you would require certain cultural infrastructure. That means education, where you can teach your children in the language that you've been taught up in, but also make sure that cultural transfer happens, where you can help your children to be proud of who they are and to remain who they are. Now, this happens automatically for most of the Xhosa cultures and Zulu cultures, and all black cultures have institutions or the traditional leadership, etc., initiation schools where cultural education or cultural transfer would happen. Afrikaners don't have that as such, due to the fact a lot of that was done through the government when the NP governed, and we had to start building that from scratch, and we're busy building that to simply enable our cultural community to survive in South Africa, but also to feel safe enough to participate and to help the rest of the country with a bigger project. And I think that's been our goal from the very start. Is Flip Bass always uses the example, says if you build a house on a street, you're not building the house in order to exclude the rest of the street. You're building the house to be able to partake in activities in the street, but you need a house somewhere where you can go and say, right, this is a space where we are safe, and this house enables participation. And the issue that we've faced in South Africa is Afrikaners are constantly marginalized in terms of every single municipality. We're a minority, and we're an absolute minority. And in international terms, it's not even that weird for a minority to be marginalized and to need some form of protection, as the South African Constitution envisages in Article 31, and I think it's 105 and 235 as well, that says minorities would need a form of protection. And we've gone one step further. Instead of demanding this protection from the government, do we think it simply isn't able to do that? We're saying we're going to try and build the things that we need. And this is the message that I think we've taken to America, saying, look, we appreciate the fact that you've seen us, you've acknowledged us as a minority. We're not going to stop anyone who thinks there's no future for them, any Afrikaner thinks there's no future for them and they want to resettle as a refugee. But the majority of Afrikaners can't do that, and they're not going to do that. What we do need, however, is a pretty standard minority rights stuff in the world, meaning we need institutions, cultural autonomy, so that we can at least decide on stuff that pertains to our culture. On bigger things like electricity and national security, obviously there we've got a long record of participating in the South African space, saying, right, this affects everyone. But when we're talking about schools and history, etc., that's something that's unique to each culture itself. And there we would like greater cultural autonomy to be able to simply decide what language our children are taught in. I don't think that's an unreasonable request. For some reason, it's been sketched as, if you read News 24, as apartheid or separate development, when this is a very standard minority rights thing throughout the world. It's a very weird way of describing Article 31 of the South African Constitution, stating that it envisions separate development, when it's just saying a cultural community has the right to maintain cultural institutions and other organs of civil society that is necessary for them to enjoy and to experience their culture to the fullest.
Let's talk about some of these specific allegations. And these have been made by people who generally are well followed in social media. Penwell the Black Pen, I know him well. He's from my hometown, in fact, in Newcastle, and he doesn't make things up. So what he's saying is a perception that he has that others share. And he gave us a list today, which he published. He said, this is what AfriForum and Solidarity's misinformation campaign hopes to achieve. Let's go through each of those if you don't mind. We start off with they want their own white Afrikaner only province in South Africa.
Okay. So I have respect for Mr. Penwell, but I think he's read a lot of things that people said about us, but not a lot of things that we actually say. There is no mention in that Washington memorandum at any point of a whites only province. In fact, we do not identify as white primarily. We're not going to do the race thing. We identify on a cultural level as Afrikaner specifically. What we are asking for is help in building out further, if possible, which we've already started, building the cultural infrastructure that would enable greater cultural autonomy, which is a form of self-determination. So in layman's terms, it means we would like to decide on ourselves on stuff that pertains to our culture. That is a very standard request. And I think it's not nearly as radical or separatist as people would want to believe. But no, that is not one of the things that we're asking at all. I have no idea where he would get. Well, I have an idea where he would get that. But in the Washington Memorandum itself, which we handed over, the express asking, well, the express request is, we're going to build these things if you help us or not. It would be nice if you help us, but we're not expecting any funds, anything. The only thing we're expecting is acknowledging that any minority in the world has a right to say we would like more cultural autonomy. We'd like to decide on things pertaining to this minority ourselves.
They want special police protection, especially for white Afrikaner farmers.
I wouldn't say white Afrikaner farmers. I would say farmers, and this is no secret. We've repeatedly stated where you've got a disproportionate focus of crime, you need a disproportionate police response. Now, the NC knows this inherently for the simple reason we had a disproportionate focus on crime on the murder of council members in Natal, if you remember correctly. And they immediately went to a commissioner that got special police forces and task forces for this crime specifically. Now, the total amount of murders is something like it's 40 or 50. It's not a lot in South African terms, but the per capita is massive. You did not have a long life expectancy if you became a council member, especially in the Escort municipality in Natal. So it just means when there's disproportionate focus, you need a disproportionate response. The same with gangsterism on the Cape Flats is there's a disproportionate amount of young colored men dying due to gangsterism, and this requires a disproportionate response by the police. The exact same for women and children is we've got a gender-based violence issue, and South Africa has inherently said, all right, that makes sense. We're killing women at a much greater rate than the other citizens, therefore we need special programs to protect them. But the moment you start mentioning the facts that says, look, farmers in South Africa are being killed at a much greater rate than your average policeman even, but definitely than your average citizen, we think this is something that should be deemed a priority crime, and that you should really put a focus with rural safety on protecting the people who are being focused disproportionately. And then we get a response that says, no, it's not even that we can argue about the numbers. It says the response that says, no, this does not happen. And that is, I think, the part that irks us, is saying, we're okay with you saying we don't have the resources to allocate or anything in those lines, but the flat-out denial almost by political leaders. Let's be fair, the police have stated the problem, but there's no political will. And that is why one of the requests is saying, just declare it a priority crime, or at least step out of the way so that rural safety structures can start addressing this focus. I don't think we've ever mentioned the color of the farmers. We're advocating for all farmers, the majority of which would in most cases be white or Afrikaans, but we're not that bothered about that part. We're bothered about the fact that farmers are being killed at a rate much greater than your average South African citizen, and therefore it needs a police response that adequately reflects that reality, not going on political grandstanding or trying to say this does not happen, which has been, unfortunately, the NC strategy for most of the last decade, saying that, well, it doesn't happen, we're making it up. When we've got lists of murdered people who we most definitely aren't making up. And that, I think that's the part it says more about how the ANC sees us as a minority than it says about anything regarding misinformation. It's one of those flashpoints in the relationship that we hope desperately to get repaired, for the simple reason we want less people to die.
They want the EFF banned and dismantled.
okay. Whilst on a personal level, I would not be that sad if the EFF does disband. I don't think we've ever publicly advocated for any grouping to be banned. We're not in the business of trying to ban other groupings. We're much more in the business of saying, market your ideas in the marketplace. We think the EFF has horrible ideas for the country. That is true. But we've never lobbied to have them banned. We have taken them to court where they've transgressed the law, however, which is something that we feel strongly about. But they're more than welcome to continue on their race to the bottom, which they were busy with at the moment.
They want special trade agreements for white Afrikaners with the West.
No, I think we want special trade agreements for South Africa with the West, quite simply put. South Africa has an enormously advantageous trade agreement with America and AGOA. It is one of the things that really helps our country. Now, Solidarity has, I think the movement has 600,000 members, but a minuscule portion of that actually works in industries that would benefit from AGOA. I know there's this idea that we only started lobbying because AGOA would affect the farmers and that would affect our members. But AGOA would affect much, much more than simply agriculture. It's vehicle manufacturing, etc., where we don't have massive amounts of members. And the reason we're lobbying for this is because, according to our research, we would lose at least 300,000 jobs as a country, closer to 600,000. Now, that is something that creates a massive socioeconomic crisis if we, as a country who's not growing, lose another 600,000 jobs. And although we're Afrikaners, we're also South African. And that means we want the country to grow. We've been on record repeatedly slamming government's policies that inhibit growth. And the reason for that is, without economic growth, South Africa does not go forward. We are going to stagnate and try and redistribute a crumbling pie. Whilst there's no reason for this, we can easily lift people out of poverty if we just follow a couple of certain economic principles that has been proven to work in other countries. And that this is much more out of that point of view that says, look, if you're going to kick us out of AGOA, you're going to massively harm average working South Africans, the majority of which aren't our members, but they are our countrymen. And that means we obviously do not want more socioeconomic distress coming into this country than the ANC has already brought here. So please consider punishing the fat cats who are doing this, much rather than your average farm worker, factory worker, who are going to bear the brunt if America brings down the hammer with sanctions and kicking us out of AGOA.
There's a report from the Hudson Institute, and we will be getting onto that with the authors in a while. But this comes back to what Peniel was saying, or alleging about AfriForum and Solidarity. Says they want all top black politicians to be sanctioned by the West.
I think the list that we gave the Americans, or we said this is a good start, is a list not compiled by us, but compiled by Judge Zondo. It's the Zondo Commission report, which is let's try and sort out the corrupt politicians. It's a shame that nothing has been done. We have extensive evidence of these guys plundering the state, quite simply put, and the ANC has dragged their feet on acting against it. Now, you might wonder why. I would argue you tend to not move with urgency when you're prosecuting friends, which is what we've seen. And that is the list that we've supplied. We've said, look, this is the guy. This is a report by an independent commission appointed by the South African government. They've done nothing. If you want to send a message to the ANC that you need to start at some point putting the country first, not the Soviet Union first, then this is a good start to send a clear message that as America, if you want to sanction something, we're serious about South Africans and their welfare, whilst at the same time serious about your government's foreign policy or your government officials' foreign policy changing to no longer threaten America's national interests, which is the way they see it. They literally see South Africa as a threat to their national security, which I think is something that the South African government needs to handle with much more urgency and seriousness than we're doing at the moment.
Rather emotive one here. He says they want South Africans to forget about fixing the legacies of apartheid.
No. Mr. Peniel, unfortunately, I think, does not read a lot of the things that we've said. He reads a lot of things said about us, once again. Our point of view regarding this is we had a horrible racial discriminatory past. We've never tried to dismiss that at any point. But when we're trying to redress the past, we need to be very careful to not recreate it. And that means you can't redress apartheid, but you can redress the effects of apartheid, of which one was political exclusion. Now, I would argue that has been completely redressed for the simple reason we've got the franchise for everyone, full suffrage, and the ANC, well, at least black people are in control of every single lever of power in government. So you've got political redress that happened. The other one was economic redress, so meaning blacks were excluded from the economy through apartheid. So what you need to address is the effects of economic exclusion. And this would manifest as such in reducing black poverty, reducing inequality, and reducing unemployment for the simple reason that the biggest economic exclusion is being unemployed. And our problem lies in two pronged. The first is we've started redressing, but there's no indication when will we be finished. There's no finish line. When you look at the Department of Labor's regulations, once you've reached a labor force that is 80% black, 9% white, 9% colored, and 2% Indian, you may never go back. They will continue in perpetuity, from what we can see, in enforcing that this labor, this is the way your labor force should look. Now, then we're not talking about a redress. Affirmative action internationally, redress measures are by definition temporary. It's a temporary measure after which we go back to a non-racial situation where we're not using race anymore. From what the ANC envisions with this is a permanent system of racial preference. Now, that's not something that we think South Africa should be doing. But worse than that, when we look at the outcomes of this policy, and it's important to judge policies by their outcomes, not by their intentions. When we look at the outcome on the three things it should have addressed, it has moved the needle in the opposite direction in all three. Poverty is up. South Africa is a poorer country. According to the World Bank itself, our GDP per capita is the same as it was in 2007. So we've not moved forward at all. We've become poorer. Unemployment is significantly up, with black unemployment specifically being at almost 46% extended definition now. So that means whatever policy was meant to include black people in the economy has dismally failed in doing it. And inequality is up. With a unique thing, inequality is no longer primarily between racial groups. It's now within groups. So that means black inequality is driving South Africa's inequality. So what this policy has done, and that's the key, is it has created a small elite who have become extremely rich at the expense of everyone else. And this elite is obviously fighting hard to become richer. And that's why you have absurd policies like create 100 black industrialists or a transformation fund whose goal is to change black millionaires into black multimillionaires whilst the rest of the country languishes in poverty and unemployment. And we're simply stating, one, we need to know what the finish line looks like. When will we be redressed? And at what point do we now say, all right, we've done this for the reason Afrikaners and white people are a minority in the country. So the idea that you can redistribute yourself to wealth is not going to work when you're taking from 8% and trying to give to 80%. It's just never going to manage. The only way is growth. And secondly would be, we're not saying do nothing. We're saying do something else. We've now tried this for 30 years. It has not, in any measurable metric, worked. Continuing down this road would be madness. It would enrich an elite even further. We're stating, let's try something else. Let's try income as a measure, and let's try policies that lead to growth, because ultimately growth leads to less unemployment. And once we get unemployment down, then we can start addressing meaningful inequality and actually get your average South African citizen into the middle class, which is what I think the goal should be, to redress the effects of the past. So it's not that we're dismissing the effects. We're saying if you bake a cake and it fails consistently with the same recipe for 30 years, at some point you need to think, it doesn't help that I'm trying harder on this recipe. I need to try something else. And that is where South Africa is now. We need to try something else to get these problems under control. That is what we've been advocating for 10, 15 years. If we've stated these policies won't work, they're going to lead to poorer service delivery. And what they did lead to, unfortunately, is on these three, it didn't move the needle. But then if you read the Zondo report as well, it led to massive endemic corruption due to the fact that they created loopholes for tenders and for carters, tenderpreneurs to come through, and for cater deployment to really enrich a small elite. And that is our main criticism on this. So we've not stated that the past did not happen, etc. We're saying I don't think we're dealing with it well in the present.
There are two of the issues that he raises, which I'm sure we don't really need to go in. They want the Expropriation Act scrapped. I don't think there's any question there that anybody with a half a brain wants it scrapped. And that they want the Kill the Boer song banned. Again, that's quite obvious. But let's get on to the final one, which is they want BEE scrapped. Now, I had a chat yesterday with Gabriel Krauss, and for many years, Gabriel Krauss's organization, the Institute for Race Relations, was an opponent of the old government, the old apartheid government. So take it from whence it comes. But he says that with the analysis that he's done, BEE is costing South Africa 150 billion rand a year. Were it to be scrapped, we would be able to take VAT down to 11.5%. This is incidentally just the cost as far as the procurement is done by the state, let alone the costs of lost investment and in the private sector. From your side, from AfriForum movement side, do you want BEE scrapped?
I think we, as we said, where we view this policy and review this policy, it simply has not worked. It has created a massive premium. Now, we've done extensive research on the cost of BEE in Eskom, for example. And in Eskom, it increased all costs by at minimum 30%. Now, energy is a primary input for the whole economy. So you can imagine that filtered through to every single business. And it is cold comfort for your minimum wage earner that their protein staples are more expensive by a certain degree, because energy to keep the fridge going is more expensive due to the fact that some connected ANC caterer somewhere needs to buy a new Mercedes. This is the effect of this policy, has been to enrich a few at the cost for millions of South African citizens. So scrapping it in totality is something that we think should be seriously considered. Our proposals to the government, which we've stated repeatedly, is the first is at least exempt international investors from BEE. If you're stating you need to redress the past, there's no reason why a company like Starlink should subsidize that, which they've stated expressly. And what you're doing is you're keeping international investment or foreign investment out of the country for rent seeking. And that is what this has become. It's become a racial rent seeking exercise. It's become nothing else. In South Africa itself, if you really want to buy patronage, then we need to do that with growth, which means viewing some international examples that have these policies. There's a hard ceiling that says below a certain percentage, preferential procurement does not happen anymore. Then the government can't afford to be inefficient. South Africa has grown at 0.6 and 0.8, and it's been lackadaisical at best, but we've insisted on redistributing the shrinkage to connected people, to the political connected people. From our perspective, scrapping it in totality would do much more for empowering poor black people economically than anything else. But we can understand if you say, right, we need to, at some point, in pragmatist terms, we can't just scrap the system tomorrow. We need to phase it out. And that's why the thing that we're pushing for is saying all of these measures are meant to be temporary. They're meant to be a temporary redress. We want to know, when will we be redressed? At what point? What does it need to look like? Because you can't start a measure if you're not saying, okay, this is what success looks like. So what would success look like? And we've got the inkling feeling that from the government's point of view, at least, success is keeping the system in perpetuity, in which case this flies against all international norms and standards regarding these measures. It flies against the U.S. Supreme Court decision that said you can't have a constant target. When it has been reached, you need to then relax these measures to once again move back to a merit-based society. And I think that's the pity of South Africa, is if you look at the polling amongst average South Africans, the people want a merit-based society. They want a government that works. They don't want a government that redistributes to connected people. They want a government that simply works. And they have no problem with saying, let's do this on a merit-based situation. It's the ANC and the connected caterers that have a massive problem, because this is their lifeline. They're the ones who are profiting of this. We're of the opinion, if we can scrap racial rent-seeking tomorrow, let's do it. But pragmatically speaking, let's get an end date. Let's say, all right, this is the point at which, as a country, or the point or the target where we've now had enough, or we've redressed. And then we can give effect to the definition that the Department of Labor itself states, which is affirmative action is a temporary set of measures. So let's talk about the temporary. At what point does it stop?
Connie Mulder is the head of Solidarity Institute. Thanks for giving us your time and going through these questions in such detail. It is a issue that has arisen and at the moment seems to be dominated by headlines or the shortest and most emotive tweet. Hopefully those who really do want to know where you stand will take the time to unpack and to reflect on what you've just said, and I'm sure Penmore will be amongst those. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.